This week, all three major indices are attempting to print new record highs. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's great to be with you here on this August 3rd show and another two big guest interviews. Season 13, episode 655, we discussed the strong economic numbers that continue to put the precious metals under pressure, but the negativity is reaching critical levels. It's been said it's always darkest just before the dawn. Are the gold bulls preparing for a stealth stampede? Joining me with their thoughts on the topic, two more big industry guests, including Arch Crawford, head of Crawford Perspectives. He outlines his technical outlook. $1,200 gold could be solid support, and I agree with him. And Peter Leides of Stock Market Cycles returns with his insights. He notes that the RIDEX bearish funds indicate that investors are the least bearish in 20 years. That might be a sign of an overbought equities market. And we'd like for you to call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. The number again, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Cloudy skies persisted over the precious metals sector as investors turned to the U.S. dollar on strong U.S. GDP numbers and unemployment report, which continues to indicate the Fed will hike rates at the September and December meetings. Gold ended the week near break-even, finishing at $12.23. Silver gave back just 3 cents at $15.46, while the XAU precious metals shares gave back 70 cents, about a percent, closing at $76. Black gold was near break-even as well, off just 20 cents, ending at $68.50, and the Bitcoin Investment Trust, though, gave back much of recent gains, down $1.80, 15%, at $10.15. We hope that's strong support. We hope it holds. And the Tezos pre-tokens gave back just about 10% at $1.80. And our lead stock analyst, Peter Spina, added Halo tokens to his portfolio. We continue to watch the Halo project with strong interest. Moving on, the top story in the precious metals sector, gold prices edged higher. Friday, on the heels of the strong GDP number, the U.S. economy grew at 4.1%, and the latest U.S. jobs report revealed unemployment rate actually ticked lower. However, the Labor Department did show fewer jobs were added to the payrolls in July than expected, 157 in July versus 195,000 forecasts. Still, as mentioned earlier, the 3.9% versus 4% unemployment, another good indication of the economy. In related news, lower national unemployment should give Fed policymakers all the ammunition needed to bump up interest rates two more times this year. The current Fed funds futures probability from the St. Louis Fed indicate 94% probability at the next meeting slated for September and 67% probability of a second rate hike at the December meeting. Bottom line, precious metals. Well, one media source noted local jewelers are recording solid purchases from eager precious metals buyers, which could add to the seasonably favorable market ahead of the holiday season. For the time being, though, the strong U.S. dollar has the precious metals under pressure, but once that passes, the XAU and the metals do appear to be near strong support. And we like that pattern unfolding in the metals that could suggest explosive moves higher in the weeks and months ahead. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange on Friday as investors cheered the dual positive economic growth figure against the backdrop of a robust employment number. The Dow added to last week's gains 39 points at 25,058 above the psychological support level at 25,000. The S&P 500 was up 21, ending at 2840, while the NASDAQ rebounded sharply off the lows, recovering in strong fashion, adding 75 and finishing at 78.12. Hard to believe. The top story impacting the equities markets, shares roared back from weakness earlier in the week on solid economic figures. Investors continue to ignore the trade war, big rate increases, tightening Fed balance sheet, focusing instead on the solid economic output and nearly full national employment. The U.S. has threatened to levy tariffs on all half a trillion dollars of China's exports, our number one trading partner and second largest economic superpower, which includes agriculture, metals, tech, and more. China on Friday, though, announced it's preparing to impose at least $60 billion retaliatory tariffs on American goods if they penalize any more imports. Plus, the EU economic ministers now have plans to follow in the Fed's footsteps, curtailing quantitative easing operations by increasing their rates and shrinking their balance sheet as well. The major superpowers are concerned by the risk of uncontrolled inflation, something which their models have little or no ability to contain once it's out of the bottle. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, although the equities advance stalled somewhat this week, as expected in the last report, U.S. shares came roaring back, and the 7 indicator greed to fear index pendulum remains in the greedy category for the second week running. However, I don't really see any major clouds on the horizon suggesting that the bullish trend is in jeopardy. It looks like a neutral rating. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. It's time for another GoldSeek.com radio episode. Today's featured guest, Arch Crawford. Well, my featured guest uses technical analysis and the planetary alignments to find anomalies and identify patterns in the financial markets. Arch has been at the helm of Crawford Perspectives for over four decades. Welcome back, Arch Crawford.
Well, thank you. I've had the newsletter 41 years. My experience in the market goes back to December 1950.
That's got to be 60 plus years.
Yes.
A lot going on in the markets. You want to just kick off with the U.S. equities market. We had a little pullback.
Well, we've had rising wedge patterns in both the SPX, the S&P cash, and the Dow Jones cash. And I said they usually break to the downside, and actually the Dow Jones one broke before my July letter, so I mentioned that it was the weakest and was leading on the downside. So in the meantime, the SPX broke down, stopped just below the 50-day moving average and on a significant trend line, and rallied all the way back up and passed the high, but to the bottom of the rising wedge, and now it's dropped away from it 2 or 3 days, and that is just a perfect sell signal. It's a top on Wednesday at 1 o'clock, which is before the FOMC meeting. The FOMC usually takes the market up for the 2 days, and I want to be doubled up short by 1 o'clock latest.
Don't you agree that shorting in a massive multi-year uptrend, shouldn't we qualify by saying that's very much a trader's mentality, looking for very brief anomalies in the market? Is that fair to say?
Fair to say, but I believe that the deterioration is more serious than that, particularly in the new highs and new lows. And I find that after a period of new lows, being very low, and they rise up to 40 or better for 3 days in a row, that is a short-term sell signal. Well, the last 9 days, we've had 2 days over 40 and then not, 2 days over 40 and then not, 2 days over 40 and then not. So it's flirting with the sell signal, but it has not given it. But the SPX kissing the bottom of a rising wedge pattern is a little more significant, and we're going into the Mercury retrograde and between eclipses.
Don't forget the blood moon.
Well, that was the eclipse. Lunar eclipse was the of the last century.
The majority of our listeners today, unlike I'm sure your subscribers, the majority of them are buy and hold portfolio builders. That's what we advocate here. And we have no problem with traders. We should really make it clear that you're not happy with the short-term price action. You probably would concede that we could easily see a 50 to 100% doubling from the current share prices. You don't see the Dow at 50,000 or 75,000?
It'll be because of a rampant runaway inflation and not because of value.
You know, Martin Armstrong, he sees money flows that simply can't find a yield or any security worthwhile. As the U.S. dollar and dollar-denominated assets as the refuge of last resort, And certainly the U.S. equities money flows could continue to remain positive for a couple more years. That's what makes the markets, right? Different perspectives. I think we've got a good feel for equities. Arch says let's stay away from them for a while. Let's move on to the precious metals. You know, we had really robust economic growth, apparently a little less than was expected, but 4.1% GDP from April through June, first quarter, fastest pace in years. And I'd like to know if you expect that to continue and what it just might mean.
You're asking me about the metals.
I was leading up to that and the potential for inflation, a robust red-hot economy, strong stock market.
When I wrote the July letter, it had broken a minor uptrend line, a light line on my chart. And I said, minor break, will it get worse? And sure enough, it got worse. And then it broke the heavy, and now it's broken the 200-day moving average, a 200-week moving average, excuse me. I don't see any positives about it, except that we are near fairly strong support at 1,200, and it's now 1,234. I'm not positive on them right now. I think everybody should have some that they should leave to the next generation, because the dollar always goes down in value over time. So you should have something to negate that. And, of course, maybe the Bitcoins could do that. We don't know yet. They haven't been going around that long.
You know, we see maybe a 20 to 30-fold climb in the next 3.5 years by 2022. Potential. But it's one of those opportunities where we like to use the proviso. This can just as easily go to zero as it could go to the moon. The big thing that's been bumping up the market, as we understand it, is that a major investment house opened up a Bitcoin and cryptocurrency trading desk. When word of that got out, we were just about to break down into a bear market. If we break below 5,700, Katie bar the doors, here comes 3,000 or 4,000. That precise moment as it just stabilized, this news came out. Some major hedge fund or institution that they were buying hand over fist has opened up a trading desk, so they have dedicated traders on that market so that they can distribute them among the accounts, their accounts and their clients. That was the word on the street, and frankly, I haven't read too much more about it at this point.
December newsletter, I wrote about a certain that was likely to be a top level market, stock market or certain groups or currencies or even metals. I don't remember if I specifically mentioned Bitcoin or not, but the date that I mentioned for the top, I didn't realize was a Sunday, and it was the exact top day in the Bitcoin.
Yeah, it was looking awfully toppy there at 20,000. We issued our buy on Goldseek at around 900 for the GBTC ETF, for Bitcoin ETF, and we started getting very nervous around 10,000. So I have to admit my exit was a little early, but if you think about it, it's still under 10,000 today, so maybe that exit is a little more insightful in retrospect in the rearview mirror. But
in today's newsletter, it has just in the last week or two broken up through a downtrend, willing to begin accumulating it again.
It moves at 5 to 6 fold a typical market Bitcoin. If you were a weekly trader, you could trade it day to day because of that differential there. And I think that's the general consensus in the markets. It moves remarkably quickly. So if we've just witnessed a bear market, which on a percentage basis it certainly represented, on a longer-term logarithmic chart, I would argue it was just a blip. But if we've just witnessed a bear market, most markets would take 4, 5, 6 years to do that, and we've probably completed one, we hope, a fraction of 4 or 5 years, you know, in a matter of 7 or 8 months. I do think you have to look at it in perspective. If you recognize that 99% of that percentage change upside occurred within a 2-week period, step back a little bit and say, well, we had a frothy moment like we tend to do at the end of the year, almost every year. Let's move on to the FOMC. This week, policymakers will make a decision on the benchmark overnight lending rate. Currently, the Fed funds futures are showing virtually zero odds or probability of an upcoming meeting, about 90% that we will see them hold pat until the September meeting, where we'll almost certainly see another quarter point bump up. And then December, again, about 2/3 probability of another final rate hike, let's hope. What do you think? How's this going to impact the markets?
I think this is another one of those meetings where you have to pay close attention to what they say rather than what they're going to do, so we'll be paying attention. I said before the last one that if they raised again, it would tank the market, and it did, to be a little more cautious.
So we'll be looking for forward guidance from the Fed following the meeting. And then we'll look for those Fed minutes from the Fed speak, the rhetoric, Fed governors. I guess it's now Jerome Powell is our current Fed chief, who probably reports directly to the Treasury Secretary, Robert Mnuchin, if I'm not mistaken. So that's what we have to look for. So in other words, it looks like a non-event. More than likely, they hold rates steady. And as long as they don't say anything too scary, it's more of the same.
I just don't think we'll have too many non-events here with Mercury retrograde and but still between important eclipses. Anything can happen.
So anything could happen could be, let's say, a deterioration in negotiations with the trade war, current trade tariffs that are in place with our top trading partners, as well as maybe North Korea. We might see some deterioration there or some rogue event. Who knows? That's what the constellations seem to imply.
Anything could happen. You know, it's Mars has been the closest and the brightest. And, of course, we have all these fires going.
Let's talk about Redding, California. This is a disaster, a human tragedy, not just human, but ecologically, wildlife, pets, homes, unfathomable. I mean, just after last year, one of the worst series of fires in Southern California, now it's Redding, California, where they've lost close to, one of the reporters talked about 120 miles square, and she was showing a subdivision burned to the ground. I've reached out to the governor and their fire authorities in California, but I believe I have a really doable solution to much of this carnage that's going on. I noticed something in last year's fires. I think I may have mentioned this to you. They would show neighborhoods just wiped out, embers, nothing but smoke and embers, and there'd be one lone building in the middle of it standing, or two. And guess what those two buildings had in common that the other buildings did not? One had a metal roof. The other had a terracotta roof. Embers flying through those California winds, gusty winds. The embers remain live. They land on a tar roof, but within 15, 20 minutes, you have an inferno. If you will just incentivize, give an economic tax break incentive for people and help them out, for people to switch out from tar roofs, it doesn't have to cost more than $2,000 to $5,000 per home. This is not like rebuilding a whole neighborhood. So my idea was then, since the authorities would not listen, why not contact the insurance companies and say, give them massive breaks, because your claims will be a tiny fraction of what they would have been otherwise. Well, moving on here, clearly the techs did tumble last Friday. They were terribly happy. A few bucked the trend. People very disappointed in Facebook, its biggest one-day loss in market capitalization. Okay, in the U.S. dollar, I've never seen it struggle like this to get over resistance. At least six or seven failed attempts in the weekly chart to break the, I want to say it's the 200-period moving average. Do you expect the greenback to reassert itself here on the fact that we have probably two more rate hikes coming down the pike in 2018?
Well, the dollar index has been hanging between 93 and 95 for a couple of months. And although it's been up over 95, I don't think it's closed above 95. It has. It's been only been once. My guess is that it will pull back down to the 91 level, and that would give us a, if it goes down to 91 and then comes back up to 95, it'll be a perfect head and shoulder bottom pattern of about a year and a half long. I would say that would give us the possible upside. If it doesn't turn into that, then much more questionable how it's going to end up.
And anything else? Crude oil bounced last week. Do you see increasing tensions in the Middle East, which always, almost always seems to be the case? Do you see crude oil continuing much higher?
The story this week is that the world usage has exceeded the input. The outflow has exceeded the input.
Okay, so peak oil.
Yeah. So that leaves us in a condition where it could spike on the near term, but I don't think it'll spike on the long term.
So you think then economic conditions worldwide may slow? I see something a little different. I mean, it's not to say that you don't make a valid point here, but I personally think that with the current leadership we have in the United States, that as much as their blowback as we've had from the population, the corporations just love it. As long as they're happy in hiring and their profits remain relatively strong. Another important caveat, let's not enter a trade war. I know that word has been overused, I think you might agree here, but if this were to accelerate and every single good or the overwhelming majority of goods imported and exported by our top trading partners and the U.S. became subject to this insipid tax, wouldn't you agree that might just change all the economic models?
About that, I think that Trump is probably doing the right thing in demanding more, at least more fair action in the tariff situation. And he says what he wants to do is have no tariffs, but apparently the United States has agreed to take greater burden of tariffs than they dish out. And I have the feeling that our politicians have been taking money under the table to give a bad deal to America and a good deal to the other place, country, whichever.
It's interesting you'd say that because we had a guest, Louis Navelier, good friend of the show for over a decade. He knows Larry Kudlow personally. He's been on Larry's show, who sadly had a heart attack, as I understand it, in the North Korea negotiations. As I understand it, he's a key advisor on this trade tariff situation in Washington. According to Louis Navelier, the ultimate goal here is sound, to reverse extremely unfavorable and very unfair protectionist policies that have been in place for decades. And as a result, it might just send economic conditions even higher or into even a more robust position. That's our hope here.
There is so much hate against Trump that I don't know if there'll be people on the side of trying to hold the market up, and there'll be people on the side of trying to tear the market down to make him look worse.
We don't cover any of that here, but you probably make a good point. It will be something to watch closely. You know, maybe that's the catalyst that ignites what you're seeing in the constellations and the heavens. Who knows? Let's hope not. I don't like hearing all this talk of potential civil war in the blogosphere. People are very upset. I've never seen such polarity.
It's heavy propagandizing 24/7.
Yeah, I think it's the propaganda machine is certainly running overtime, tail wagging the dog or vice versa. The other interesting question here is, are these movements being financed by enemies of the state? Get off my soapbox here. Parting thoughts for listeners on the markets.
Well, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. Everybody has their own idea about it. And I would say, I like what Art Cashin always says, be careful, pay attention, and be ready to jump.
Yes, for the fleet-footed folks, that's probably really good advice for the rest of us. You know, start reallocating some capital away from equities into more safe havens at this point, like the precious metals. Why don't you tell people a little bit more about Crawford Perspectives?
Well, this is 42nd year in publication, and we've been number one in several markets over several years at a time going back. So, but we have had our bad years too, and it's like nobody is perfect on that score in the markets, but I think we have about as good a record as the last 30 or 40 years as anyone in print.
And not to toot my own horn, I'm approaching my 20th year with the Alpha Stocks Gold and Silver Review. All right, Arch Crawford, great stuff as always. Please return.
Sure, thank you.
Peter Leides observes the major market trend cycles and watches for market swings. He's appeared on CNBC, Wall Street Week, featured in Barron's, Wall Street Journal, and Forbes magazine. Welcome back, Peter Leides.
Thanks, Chris.
I wanted to start off today with an important cycle that you mentioned pre-show.
Yeah, there is a cycle. It's quite amazing, in fact. You know, always looking for cycles, Chris, and once in a while, they'll sneak up on you, and you'll say, well, gee, why didn't I ever find that one before? And this is one of those that I keep saying, don't understand why I never found this one before. It's been especially good recently, and it runs, it's actually, I should call it more of a turning point pattern than a cycle, because when I get cycles that point to both tops and bottoms, I prefer to refer to them as turning points as opposed to cycles, and so that's the way I will refer to this one and say that it's been incredibly accurate over a long period of time, and it was supposed to have resolved around Wednesday of last week. I should say there have been ups and downs in terms of the exact number of days within the cycle. It's ranged basically from about 424 to 435 days, so a pretty close resolution because it's such a long cycle. And it was due the first, let me see if I can get these. As we're speaking, I'm trying to look quickly through. I want to give you the last resolution so you can see how impressive they have been. I know one of them was the election bottom in November of 16. So we're working forward from there, going forward 432 trading days would take you to the other resolutions of the cycle. The one before this one took us back into last year. So the 432 trading days is, of course, what, 432 divided by 252 and a half. It's around 1 3/4 years, let's say. So it's been very, very impressive. And due to resolve last Wednesday, plus or minus maybe about 5 days on either side. So we're beyond the far side of where it should have resolved, which means to me that we're kind of limited here in terms of what we should look for. If we start going to a new high again, then I would have to say that perhaps the cycle had inverted or wasn't going to work out this time. We always have excuses with cycles, of course, because it's not an exacting science, but so far it's worked out pretty well, and I think there's a pretty good chance that last Wednesday will turn out to be a top of some importance. But again, if we get above that, the highs that we saw last Wednesday, then the whole apparatus is called to question.
Well, your thoughts certainly mirror those of our second guest this week, Arch Crawford. He sees a top. I like that you add the proviso. You know, it's a decimal science. It's not exact. It's a pseudo art slash science, and we have to be prepared. Mr. Market might just change its mind. So many people seem to get egos involved into their forecasts and projections, and that's not always a great recipe for success.
Yeah, I learned that a long time ago. You learn that, I think, through experience, Chris, because there are times when you get very cocky and you say, my goodness, this thing is perfect. There's no way that it's not going to work out. And the minute you start feeling like that,
it's time to put some stops in place, right? Some trailing stops.
You've always got to have some kind of proviso and say that this is what we see, but if this works out this way, then perhaps it's not going to work out that way. You know, maybe either we're wrong or the cycle's wrong. If you can't admit you're wrong or you've been wrong in this business, then I don't think you believe in the business, because there's certainly no one that has a perfect record when projecting the market. I mean, you can't predict anything perfectly, and much less the stock market, which, let's face it, probably some of the greatest minds and the greatest software figurers are trying to work on some kind of system that's going to beat the market, and not too many people are successful at it.
The observational evidence and the experimental evidence both point to the more robust the system, the longer and the greater the success, and the more easily applicable to diverse markets and conditions. I'd like to move on, though, to the FOMC meeting this week. The Fed futures looking for virtually a lock, no rate hike this time, one at the upcoming September meeting and maybe one more in December. I know you're not big into fundamentals. You're mostly technical. Do you think, though, that the Fed might throw a wrench into the works?
Well, that's always a possibility, Chris, and it's something we've got to be ready to happen, because it's like anything else in our community. You don't want to get cocky about it, and the time when the surprises come are generally the time when everyone feels, or there's a consensus in terms of what's going to happen. And there appears to be a pretty good consensus right now that the Fed is not going to raise rates. So if they do raise rates, that's something that the market will probably react to. You know, I'm always cautious about any market reactions that take place because of news stories, because as you noted, Chris, I'm not a fundamentalist at all. That's not to say that I don't believe that fundamental events could influence the market. It's just to say that they really don't, in terms of my research, they don't do much in terms of the long-term trends. They have a trend behind them, but the shorter-term things, short to intermediate-term things, come about because of cycle resolutions. That would be my argument anyway.
I know you mostly watch the S&P blue chip indices. Any other markets such as precious metals, crude oil, Bitcoin, bonds?
I think I'd make the overall comment, Chris, about sentiment in the markets overall. This is almost an all markets thing because there appears to be no worries whatsoever about any kind of significant market pullbacks in any of the markets, especially the stock market. I saw a chart the other day that showed the money in RITEX bearish funds, the amount of assets in the RITEX bearish funds, which of course are the funds that go up as the market goes down. Those funds were at their lowest asset levels in 20 years. I mean, that's the complete history of the RITEX funds going back about 20 years, especially these hourly traded funds. So that, to me, is showing us that there's very much complacency in the markets and very little worry in terms of market risk, and that's always a dangerous situation.
How would you maybe advise a portfolio? What would be tops on your list right now?
Well, what I tell people, because I'm so very, very bearish long-term on the market, is I would never say sell everything. I've learned that lesson a long, long time ago. But what they should do is look at their portfolio and put in the trailing stops. I know a lot of people might poo-poo that and say, no, no, that's never going to work. The nice thing about trailing stops is that if I'm wrong and if someone else is wrong about the market going down, you stay with your stocks, and as they go up, let's say you have a stock that's selling for $100 a share. You put a trailing stop in at 90, 10% below. Now let's say it goes to 110. You say, well, that's wonderful. Now you go 10% below that, so right around the 100 level, you raise your stop. The nice thing about that is you can continue to ride a winner for a long, long period of time where people keep telling you sell, 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 and you say, well, I'll put my stop 10% under, and you keep trailing that. You change it maybe every month or so based on where the stock is. And that way, they're never going to get killed with the 40, 50% declines. I mean, there are instances in individual stocks where they might, we saw that in Facebook the other day. You know, if you had a trailing stop in Facebook, you might not have been too happy a person as to where that stop was executed. But overall, as a general rule, if you have your stops in ahead of time, you're going to get priced right around where your stop level is. And that protects you for the real big loss. And believe me, I couldn't say it with more confidence. There are going to be some real big losses in this market in the next couple of years.
A couple of years. I'm glad you brought that up because it brings back notions circa 1998, 1999, where even the diehard market aficionados were stunned by the tenacity of the NASDAQ in particular, but the blue chips, you know, S&P Dow Industrials. Everyone was convinced it was a top. We had a couple of scares, the Asian contagion in 97 and a few others along the way. I bet we saw the NASDAQ at least double from those levels to that ominous pink in the year 2000. What kind of odds would you put on a similar scenario unfolding here that catches the bears off guard?
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you that I rule anything out in the market. I think the odds on that are low probability if you're talking about anything near, never mind a doubling, but an additional gain of 20, 30, 40%. I'd say the odds on that are in the teens somewhere, probably maybe 20, 25% at the most. So I think the odds are overwhelmingly in favor of something like that not happening. But again, there's nothing in the market I would ever rule out, Chris.
What would you say to the more traditional investor fond of building a portfolio and isn't comfortable going to cash because they've been so punished in the past whenever they've tried to do that? What are some alternatives that you like or advocate, such as a bearish fund for each of the extremely frothy components in their portfolios, and those who want to stay away from the obvious options hedging strategies?
I mean, you just mentioned a really good idea. If you are in that category and you say, hey, I'm not going to cash. Here's what I'll do. I'll take maybe 60-70% of my assets that are in the market and remain there. And then I'll take 15 or 20% of my assets and put them either in a bearish fund or even in a leveraged bearish fund where you get returns of 2-1 to the downside. If you did that in and of itself and by itself, that would be a very risky procedure. But if you do that in association with long positions that you have, then you at least have yourself some kind of protection on the downside.
Your contact information?
Our website is stockmarketcycles.com. They can always get our latest report there. We come out with reports now. We don't have the subscription service anymore, but we come out with reports every 4 to 6 weeks generally. We just did a special report last week, Chris. In fact, so far we lucked out by hitting the exact high on the Wednesday, and we told people we thought that would be a very important high because of the cycle. So perhaps maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it a little bit in the interview.
Look forward to hopefully hearing your thoughts again in 2018.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
It's just a real pleasure to welcome the Chief Market Strategist at ITMTrading.com on her Gold Seek radio debut, Lynette Zhang. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it is my pleasure, and it's very, very flattering, Chris. So I'm very happy to be here today.
We were talking on the pre-show discussion about the fantastic stuff you've done on inflation and hyperinflation.
For anybody that would think that this cannot happen, you know, I would say that you have not looked at history, and people have a very short memory. But really, with the work on, you know, the whole point of inflation and the benefit of that is, you know, for governments. And should I back up and kind of explain money first? Find that most people really don't understand money, though we work for it and we try and save it.
And ironically, it's economists that seem to struggle with this topic, some at least. I think you make a great point. We could all use a primer, couldn't we?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not that complicated. I mean, I'm not saying that a lot of this stuff isn't, but they needed money way back when. They needed money so that they could fairly value labor, so we could have segregated jobs. You can have a banker and a baker and a shoemaker. So they needed a way to value money and store any excess labor that you generated today for use in the future. But the goal was to have it retain its purchasing power so that no matter when you use that money, you were always paid fairly for your labor. Over time, they tried a lot of different things. I mean, you can't live without water, but water isn't a good money because it's not very portable and it evaporates. So they tried lots of things over the years, but only gold. Plus, it takes labor and energy to pull gold out of the ground. So it was a very fair way to value labor for labor. But the problem for governments and corporations was that when you tried to tax people, well, for governments, you tried to tax people on a gold standard, you knew it, and the public might not agree to it. So they needed a system that they could tax you without you knowing, and then you can just enter the Federal Reserve and the fiat money standard. Now, fiat, the literal translation for fiat, is by decree. So this is a government dictated money. And as we saw in India in 2016, any money that the government declares as money, they can also declare is no longer money.
Not only can they redefine money, but they can actually redefine the parameters, can't they? Meaning they can devalue it, as we've seen in Zimbabwe, in Venezuela, in Argentina, and many other places. Please continue.
And how about in the U.S.? I mean, seriously, according to the Federal, my very favorite website is the Federal Reserve FRED, because in there, you know, I mean, we know that they juggle numbers to make things look the way they want them to look, but I think it's more honest. So officially, according to the Federal Reserve, there's only 4 cents left out of the original dollar in value. But going, but you know, expanding on that, what they knew quite clearly was, number one, that people do not understand inflation. And inflation causes what's called nominal confusion. And this is a key, and it's not really complicated, but if you had a $20 bill 10 years ago and you have a $20 bill today, nominally, they are identical. They're both $20 bills. So you just think, oh, I have a $20 bill, and I had one then, and I have one now. But what you could buy with that $20 bill 10 years ago, or even a year ago, and what you can buy with it today, so the value of it is vastly different.
Was it the great economist John Maynard Keynes who pointed out that not one in 100 or one in 1,000 people truly understands inflation, and that's how they get away with it?
And it was John Maynard Keynes, and he created the Keynesian economic, which is what, at least at the moment, kind of what we're still going by. So yeah, that's why he said they knew that. And you know what else he said? Now, this is not a direct quote, but I do quote that regularly. But they also knew that people marry the legal money of the state. And so in this country, because a lot of times when you talk about other countries, people go, well, that's over there, that's not here. But in this country, prior to 1913, it was called the dollar. Although a 20th of an ounce of gold was interchangeable and supported that dollar. After 1913, legally, because the Federal Reserve is neither federal nor do they hold reserves, it's a private bank, but legally they had the right to print $2.40 for every dollar, for every 20th of an ounce of gold they held.
Ironically, on the dollar itself and on the bills, it actually shows it's a debt instrument. It uses the term note, which of course implies debt.
And that's absolutely right. And a note is a debt instrument. And so, and actually, part one, I just started a series on hyperinflation, so I'm not sure that you saw that yet. Part one was on the dollar. And in there, the Treasury actually says, well, we don't really have to worry about zero coupon debt, i.e. currencies. Right? Because they're not paying interest on debt. Currencies don't pay you interest. They charge you inflation, but they don't physically yet charge you interest. So they were transitioning us into a debt-based system, which was still partially backed by gold until 71. Now, we hear all the time that, well, Nixon took us off the gold standard. Oh, like, no big deal. But what people need to understand was the gold for the public. If you were not happy with what the government was doing, you could simply walk into any bank and convert the paper dollars in your pocket into physical gold. Pull that gold out of the system.
I wonder, though, if the typical millennial, even X generation, if they can even conceptualize this profound idea that you've brought up today that I think is so central. These are promises for something tangible, and they no longer are.
And just kind of expounding on that, I mean, originally and in the Constitution, it was the individual that was supposed to be at the top. And then the states were supposed to support individual rights, and the federal government was supposed to support the states. Well, that's not really the way it works anymore, is it? It's all about the federal, and the public is down at the bottom. But this doesn't happen overnight, because if it happens overnight, then you get rebellion, which is the same thing as inflation and hyperinflation. The only difference between the two is the speed of the inflation. And the brilliance of Keynesian economics was this was the first time in history that central bankers had actually attempted to control the rate and speed of inflation. So when they took away the gold from the citizens in 33, you know, all of this is planned. I definitely have to do a book on that period in time, because I've studied it so much, and my book will be very different than what is taught in schools, but it's all based upon facts that, you know, that anybody can research. It's not like, I'm definitely not an insider, and it's not like I have a special key. And I will dig and dig and dig until I find the information, and I'll follow strings. So getting back to what happened in in 33, they took away our ability to hold government toes accountable because they took the gold away from us. But the countries still had that. Now in 44, the US dollar became the world reserve currency. And what that actually means is that if you are a country or a government or a corporation going outside of your borders to buy anything, you had no other option but to do so with US dollars. And in exchange for this extreme privilege, the US agreed to keep the dollar's value at $35 for 1 ounce of gold. But the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was created at that time to oversee us to make sure that we actually lived up to our part of the bargain. So we were then the only country in the planet that could actually create the money that they needed to pay international debts. That's why we've lived the high life for this long. But when we started funding the Vietnam War, we started printing more dollars than we had in deep storage, than gold we had in deep storage. And the rest of the world recognized it. And there was a run on the dollar in the 60s, so much so that by 1971, when Nixon quote-unquote took us off the gold standard, what he really did, which is egregious, is he handed over full control of the value of the money that we work for and attempt to save to banks who only know debt and leverage. So when he disallowed the ability of countries to convert their dollars into gold because they didn't like how we were devaluing our currency, we broke that pledge, we defaulted on that agreement. Well, guess what? Once Nixon said, nope, can't do it, you know, from there forward, it's been the bankers.
This is such a key point, and there was an interesting article penned recently that compared the petrodollar arrangement to a tokenization, if you will, because we're all, you know, becoming familiarized today with the cryptocurrency revolution, and, you know, whether you're a believer or not, what Nixon did was tokenized petrol. It forced most of the industrialized world to accept dollars, obviously, in exchange for oil. Today, that petrol arrangement is starting to implode. We're losing dollar hegemony.
Because it was just, I think it was last month or was it in March, when for the first time, China actually, you can now buy oil with yuan. But look at also what's happening in Saudi Arabia with Aramco. I mean, they are shifting, and they've been the one, they've really been the one to control the Middle East and oil production, etc. And so, you know, now they want to sell off a part of their Aramco, and it's really interesting, because when they first started talking about that, you know, oil was down at what was below $50 a barrel. And so now, by the time they bring that IPO out, and it could very well be on China's exchange, because Aramco and China are very commingled now. To go back to your thought, yeah, we retained that position because of the petrodollar, because oil was a huge key, and it still is. Energy, especially when you're talking about cryptos, well, if you're talking about general mining, that does require a tremendous amount of energy. And so China has actually been going around the world creating strategic partnerships and buying up all of, as much of the energy reserves as they can globally. And we can easily see that the power is shifting to China. So essentially in 71, after the bankers were in control of everything, they pushed interest rates all the way up above 20% in the early 80s. Those that are, I'm 63, so I definitely remember having a 5-year 15% CD. And I remember what happened to gold, you know, on the spot market, the intraday close, and they knew this. You know, gold is money. It is the primary currency money. It has been for 5,000 years. And they knew that there was going to be a huge rush to gold. So they, and, you know, we talk about the tokenization. Well, in the early 70s, they went on a path of, they call it dematerialization. So there's a lot of different directions we can go with in that, but in particular, what they really wanted to do was they created the spot gold market to generate volatility because they could control a paper gold market, right? You can create as much gold as you want to if you don't have to pull it out of the ground and it doesn't exist anywhere. And so by generating a spot gold, they could control that market, generate the volatility, and keep people away from gold. And they went on a campaign so that you did not think about it as money. That goes back to what you were saying earlier about the millennials and understanding any of this stuff. But I got to tell you this, if you had a dollar in your pocket in July of 1971, and you had a dollar in your pocket in September of 1971, even if it was a brand new dollar, they looked pretty much identical.
I regularly give our 5-year-old, Sammy, and his cousins these relics of the past, silver coins, with the hope that it'll catch some traction in those fertile minds of theirs, because they spend, even at these early ages, so much time in front of screens, in front of monitors, in front of iPhones, in front of iPads. Whether or not that's healthy, I doubt it, but it seems to be the trend. How in the world will the millennials and the later generations connect to this idea of sound money?
Well, you could give them a job, right, and ask them if they would like to be paid in this silver dime, or that they can take, that you will convert into a barterable tool, so you'll give them $1.20 for that dime and take them to the store, right, so they can spend it, or you could give them a debt contract and offer them to owe you money that they have to go find someplace else.
Nate, one of the things I really wanted you to address, brought it up in the pre-talk, is this idea that hyperinflation or inflations are cropping up everywhere.
People, really, you need to understand this. And all you have to do is look, is believe your own experience, okay? Break free from that. It isn't that these things are cropping up everywhere. It's that the very beginning of this experience was, or experiment really, was 1913. And we are now at the very end of this experiment, where even the one that they started in 71, taking us to a pure debt-based system, well, what are the tools that they have to control the speed of inflation? So yes, this is a global issue, but I want you to think about the two key tools.
Well, you have your interest rates, right? The Fed funds futures from the FOMC. You have to wonder, are they pushing on a string there? I mean, how valid is this tool?
I want to talk to you about that, because I kind of fell into it. But let's kind of explain that one a little more deeply, because if a government wants to create inflation, they want you to go out and spend. Well, what they really want you to do is borrow. So they drop interest rates all the way down on average into each recessionary cycle. They've dropped them about 5.5%. That inspires people to go out and borrow and spend. And then when people notice how fast the inflation is going up and they want people to stop, to slow that, they want to slow that inflation down, they simply raise interest rates, which discourages people from borrowing to spend. Well, since 2008, and there's no doubt about it, the system died in 2008. I have all the data and the proof on it, and I just found the smoking gun Friday morning at 4 a.m., and I had been all ready to present this information on what happens to contracts during hyperinflation as part of the series I'm doing, but I actually found how they are doing it now globally into what you and I have been talking about, so I absolutely want to address it. Well, keep in mind that 90% of the industrialized world has been anchored at 0%. So the key tool that they have for inspiring people to borrow and spend is used up.
Negative interest rates at the People's Bank of China, -3% to let someone else hold your funds for you.
Right. That's been a great experience, experiment because of that, and that's why in this country, the Federal Reserve is attempting to raise rates simply, and they've said this, these are their words, not mine, so that they can drop them in the next crisis. But the goal is to get them up to 3.25%. Well, if they've always, at the average that they've dropped, they've never dropped them below 5% to try to get us out of a crisis. So even at the average of 5.5%, if we're at 3.25%, where does that take us? To negative rates. And they know us. They know this. And, you know, that takes us to cashless, which a lot of the function of the cryptocurrency, so it's all tied in. But I want to stay here for a minute because what I discovered, and it wasn't that I didn't know about it, in 2012, do you remember when the LIBOR scandal broke? What the LIBOR is, and it's critical that everybody understands it, is that there are 18 banks that every morning were supposed to tell you the real rate that they would borrow or loan money to another bank overnight.
Yeah, it's like a global overnight lending rate.
It's the overnight offer rate, interbank offer rate. So yes, that is the global benchmark. 370 trillion contracts, whether they're mortgages, credit cards, student loans, or dare I say it, derivatives, are tied to the LIBOR. But that whole thing imploded in 2008, and banks lost confidence in each other. So they were basically, I mean, now it's gone, but they were not lending to each other. So from there forward, the banks would call each other up and give them a guesstimate of how much they might have to pay or they might charge another bank to borrow money overnight. So it's a fictitious number, which is still going on today. 70% of the 18 banks that set the rate of LIBOR are quote unquote expert opinion. There were what, 15, 16, 18, lots of banks were caught up in this scandal. And so basically that killed LIBOR, though they're still using it today. And everything got real quiet after that scandal. I mean, have you really heard very much about LIBOR? No. But, you know, every once in a while there would be an article, so I would pull it. But about 4 weeks ago now, all of a sudden, I listen to CNBC when I'm getting ready in the morning so I can hear what's going on. And all of a sudden, all I hear was LIBOR's going up, LIBOR, LIBOR, LIBOR. For like about 2 weeks every day they were talking about LIBOR. Not the negatives about it, but just that the interest rates were going up and why were they going up and, you know, all that CNBC garbage. So I said to myself, well, something must be going on. Why are they suddenly magically bringing up LIBOR? So I started just kind of gathering data and throwing it on one of the PowerPoints. And then I said, okay, time to talk about it now. So that's when I started to dig in. And what I discovered, even going back to the articles that I pulled that I completely forgot about, was that in July of this past year, London gave a drop-dead deadline on when the LIBOR would be ended. And that is the end of 2021. Okay, well, why does that matter? Because there's a minimum of $370 trillion in contracts that are tied to the LIBOR. 65% of those mature after 2021. So every single one of those contracts, they call it, must be quote-unquote amended. But in reality, they must be defaulted, paid, or restructured. That is what's going to push us into the reset. So all these global central banks have been working furiously on coming up with an alternative. But the problem with any of these alternatives is that they are calculated differently than the LIBOR is right now, which means that when they make this attempted shift, and I'll go into that a little bit more in detail, but when they make this shift, those contracts, the value of those contracts will not match. Now, that might not matter to an individual, but a bank that holds a lot of these contracts and their level of debt and everything else that they can do is tied to that, that's going to matter a whole lot.
So many folks, I think, in the gold crowd and related fields have been looking for that tipping point where the chaotic system implodes, and it sounds like Lynette Zeng may have identified it.
I'm 100% certain. Because they're just starting. This is why I think they started talking so much about LIBOR. Because, in London they came up with an alternative. The U.S. has come up with an alternative. But it isn't like you can't just shift all those contracts.
You sparked an idea. I listened to an analyst talk about the significance of Bitcoin in Japan, that why in the world did one of the most authoritarian societies embrace this new cryptocurrency? I mean, Bitcoin is legal tender in Tokyo, all throughout Japan. Sure, they're known for their technological progress. That's been a huge component of their revival since World War II. Nevertheless, given your thoughts, they may see the train wreck that you've identified, that you've put a date on. And so I would propose, and I'd like your thoughts, are they anticipating this potential reset? And might that be why they're looking for anything that might shield their society from the, you know, the implications?
This is my thought on that. When they went into that, now, first of all, in 92, when their monetary system imploded, their commercial real estate dropped 95%. Their residential real estate dropped 85%. Their stock markets, I don't remember off the top of my head what percentage, but their system imploded. And they have not been able to come out of that yet. So now we're into new crisis mode, and what do? They go to negative rates. What happened when they went to negative rates? People started hoarding cash, taking cash out of the system. So cash has some similarities to gold in that they were pulling the cash out of the system, which prevented them from getting charged negative rates. Because while cash does not prevent inflation, it does preserve principal, at least nominal For the government, though, the last thing they want is for people to be out, for any government. They don't want the public to be out of the system that they control.
And the velocity of money continues to plunge year after year.
Yeah, exactly. It's way worse than it was in 1933.
The Great Depression.
I mean, that was the setup to the system. They had to get people engaged in it. And so typically when there is a money standard shift, they need you to volunteer. They don't want to cram it down your throat because then you might say no. So when they allowed the central banks to print $2.4 for every 20th of an ounce of gold held in deep storage, everything had changed in the system, but they didn't want the people to know it. So they left the barter ratio the same. It was still 1-to-1, even though it was really 1-to-240, okay? And they also kept the convertibility the same. So now the average income more than tripled as the value of the currency, and you could see this in the purchasing power chart at the Federal Reserve very clearly, as the value of the currency plunged 50%. So that means that your costs doubled. Well, if your costs doubled but your income triples, do you care if your costs double? No. And what did we have in the 20s? We had the Roaring 20s. And so now you had the general public that watched all of Wall Street get really rich and saw the market going up, up, and up, even though it was manipulated then. But they wanted to emulate the people with money because the Main Street now had more money than they had in ever. So they started plying into the stock market. Well, and we know the Roaring 20s, it was a bull market in real estate, you know, in Florida and swampland. So it was in stocks, it was in bonds, interest rates dropped, and it was in real estate. I don't know. Sound familiar? And credit was flowing. You had the highest levels of credit margin. You also have a very similar division in income inequality today that you had back in 29 and 28, 29.
You might recall that we didn't have the securities laws in place that we have today.
The people that write the contracts write those contracts for their benefit.
I just wanted to point out, since you are an ex-stockbroker and obviously certainly a student of that period there, you'll recall margin was widespread. At the time, it was at least 10-to-1, which approaches options or derivatives level. Isn't it interesting that as you're drawing parallels between that period, we regularly see 50-to-1 in the futures markets. And I know many of our listeners use 100-to-1 on some currency exchanges. Do you see that as a potential precursor of this reset?
Oh, yes, I do. Because in 27, for the first time ever, up to that point, all central banks always had a charter, and it was usually for 15 to 20 years. The Federal Reserve's charter ended in 1933. A coincidence? I don't know. But in 27, for the first time ever, they were granted a perpetual charter. That was the first time. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the era of perpetual central banks coincided with the era of continuous war, the very end of the game. And going back to the interest rates, which is what bankers use to control the rate and speed of inflation. Okay, so now can you see why LIBOR is so significant? Because the LIBOR has been around since 86. But there are all of those contracts, 300 trillion derivative, notional derivative contracts are tied to the LIBOR. And when that whole thing exploded, and they stopped supporting that market that they created, because the municipalities had signed a contract, they had to still continue to pay on those contracts. Hey, those same guys that pulled this off, to reset the debt the way it should have been set up to begin with. And actually, that's under debate. But the more standardized debt. So, because there's no But I wanted to get back to the LIBOR and the derivatives because, again, it goes back. Whenever you hear the term nominal or notional, what you should just boom, no. Nobody knows how much is really at risk. Nobody knows the value. And I personally saw it. Now, I've learned how to do a screenshot, but back then I didn't, that wasn't in my repertoire. So I personally, in the Bank for International Settlements, saw the spreadsheets on the derivatives, and at that time, it was 1.48 quadrillion. And that's notional. And they admit it.
Yeah, so folks can wrap their minds around this number. That's 1.4 thousand trillion. How can we compare that? I think it was Augustus Caesar, rated the most wealthy individual to have ever lived, had just shy of $2 trillion in inflation-adjusted terms. Even Bezos today, as I understand it, only has maybe $100 billion to $120 billion.
So I'm not getting this data from anybody else. I go into the Bank for International Settlements and the reports on derivatives, and let me tell you, And the problem is that these derivatives, since 2008, these derivatives have now infiltrated every single aspect and every single entity in the global financial system. Quite interestingly, again, in that website, the Bank for International Settlements, I noticed that prior to 2008 that, you know, central banks had a little bit in there and that in derivatives, and that would make some sense if they're holding currencies and they want to create a hedge against the currencies that they're holding in reserve. That would make some sense. But once the crisis hit, you know, then you saw a massive jump in the derivatives that central banks were holding. Well, that also makes sense because, of course, you know, they bought them off the failing bank's balance sheet with taxpayer dollars. So they bought all that garbage. But subsequent to that, there was a tremendous amount of activity in the central bank arena using derivatives. I had dug and dug and dug, and then one day, a couple of years ago actually, I came across this CFTC, so that's a government agency, report on derivative use in central banks. And what was really gratifying to me, because it confirmed what I saw and what I deduced, was that they used to use it as a protectionary hedge, but during the crisis and after the crisis, because I think this report came out in 2014, if I remember correctly, but subsequently, they have been using it to speculate. Now, let's think about this a little bit. The central banks, this is a central bank-led rally. The central banks can control what happens to markets, and then they can bet on that.
This 2021 reset, which interestingly seems to coincide with so many prognosticators, that time frame, give us an idea of what you see unfolding.
You know, you got $370 trillion at least that must shift. All of those contracts must reset. In the area where it comes to the general public, we don't have any option. It's written into the language of the contract. I'm pretty sure nobody read the thousands of fine print that when they signed their mortgage or credit cards or any of that stuff. It even says it in there. That's not such a problem because the lenders have control. But in those derivative areas with all those counterparties, in most of the areas, I just did this Friday, so go and you can see it on YouTube, but every single person, entity must agree. You going to get everybody to agree? I don't think so. And look at what's happening out there right now. You've got the Fed that's bent on raising interest rates, but you've got Japan's Kuroda Central Bank that is just doing the opposite and actually said we're going to have to ease for a lot longer because, hey, who doesn't know when something isn't working, just keep doing more of the same thing because that's logical. I don't think you're going to get everybody to agree, and that's going to be, that's the system. I mean, that is the financial system.
Exactly. Let's step into the time machine, and let's say it's the summer of 2021. What should we expect, Lynette Zing?
Okay. First of all, I could not say that they're waiting until 2021 to actually make this shift, because if they do, they will have to do it in too rapid a fashion. So I want your listeners to understand that, is there a possibility of a misstep? Let's face it, if they get caught doing illegal, then that means that they made a misstep, because Lord knows, you know, there are headlines all the time where they got caught for misdeeds. So you're assuming that there's not going to be any misdeeds before 2021, and I would not make that assumption. If doing a report on Deutsche Bank probably tomorrow, and they are the most systemically important bank, and you need to understand everybody is incestuously commingled. So the headline could happen any time before that. I think it's going to be there's a bank holiday. It's a global bank holiday. The banks are closed. You lose all access to your money. The stock markets are closed because that was, a shock. And so the markets are halted, similar to what we saw in 2008. This time there's no dry powder left except for the IMF. So this is how they'll make the transition.
So if I understand correctly, we've crossed that event horizon. It's inevitable. Is that a fair statement?
It's 100%. The system died in 2008. It is a zombie system. And frankly, I just put this material out on our YouTube channel, so YouTube ITM Trading, last Friday, with all of the links to the documents that I'm referring to. Read them. Please, people, do your own due diligence. Don't take anybody's word and don't assume anything. Read it. It's easy reading. You'll see for yourself.
That really only leaves us with one remaining question. How can we shield ourselves? What do we do?
Well, you got to get to safety. And in my very strong opinion and what I've done for myself, I am an artist and I see patterns. And I developed a strategy based upon those historical patterns, which is what we do here. That's what all of the precious metals consultants, we've all been trained in it. And I say get to safety and food. Well, you want to be as independent as possible. So that's food, water, energy, security, community, wealth preservation, and barterability. Those last two you can do with physical gold and silver, which is truly decentralized and holds its value over time. That's its function. And we just saw, Venezuela just officially reset the price of gold. They just had an official reset on February 5th. They devalued the currency 99.6%, and on February 7th, they reset their currency against gold, and gold went up in terms of bolivars over 2,600%.
There's never really been a time where I think you'd agree there's been ubiquitous global hyperinflation. It was usually contained in the Weimar or Zimbabwe or whatnot, these other Central Europe, Hungary. These are the big examples. But now we have a systemic problem. So won't our governments try to implement some type of universal income?
Probably, because they're trying to mask what's happening. But even during hyperinflationary times, when the government's mandate, increases in minimum wages and blah, 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 it is not about you holding value. So it never keeps pace with the hyperinflation. Just like the average wage does not keep pace with the loss of value in the dollar, even though nominally, average income was $9,671. It's like $54,000 today. Sounds good, but one wage earner could support a family of four reasonably comfortably in 1971. And if you make $54,000 a year, you better have another partner that's making it, and then your week-to-week paycheck.
Even if they try to legislate, let's call it, fair income, won't the goods just disappear from the shelves? That's the lesson we've learned.
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely, because the storekeepers will not be able to replace those goods for the amount in the U.S. of dollars that they can charge. So that means that now what happens is governments go in and they take over those relevant sources. And the two biggest issues, food is the absolute biggest, period, end of discussion. That's why I became an urban farmer. And then secondly, it's medicine. And between those two things, if you can't supply your family and yourself with food, and if you need medications, you know, or, you know, medical help, you can't supply that, well, there's your depopulation.
So as we wrap up today, I think it's clear that you have certainly brought a lot of inspiration to our precious metals aficionados, which comprise the bulk of our listeners. Why don't you tell people more about your services, all they'll find at ITM Trading, and any other websites you'd like for them to bookmark?
Right. Well, definitely the YouTube channel, because we publish typically 3 days a week. So I do interviews like I'm doing as well, but and I always will, you know, pick a topic. So tomorrow's will be insider trading and Deutsche Bank. And that's just YouTube ITM Trading. But really what we do here is we deal in physical only gold, precious metals. So we can do any of them, but our specialty is gold and silver, and really developing and designing the strategies, which is the one that I'm executing, just tweaked for each individual's, you know, circumstances, goals, and what they have to work with. Our minimum is $500, because a lot of times when people hear that, they go, oh, well, I can't do that because that must be really expensive. But our minimum is $500 because we want everybody to get positioned. And then after you do that and your strategy is all developed and you build it out, we actually give you a book. So the intention is to be here throughout the whole cycle, so you know how, what, and where, and when to use your gold and silver. But in case there's a blackout or brownout, which is way beyond my control, then we still want you to know how to use it. So we're here, we're all about education and educated choices, and that's what we do.
Lynette Zhang, a wealth, a treasure trove.
Pleasure to be here.
Please return.
I will. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. All the for sale and for rent signs I'm seeing with my own eyes popping up around Denver. I've been receiving emails from subscribers describing the same thing in their area. Granted, it's only anecdotal, but I too have been observing the same kinds of changes in the real estate market. According to the article, home builder stocks are now in an official bear market, with some stocks down over 30% since late January. An inconvenient fact that has not made it into the mainstream financial media. Lots of home builder inventory is what is referred to as work in progress. However, a finished new home does not necessarily show up in the MLS system unless the builder lists it. This is why, on the surface, new home inventory might look relatively low, but home builders are showing huge inventory levels in their SEC-filed financials. This is why many have been fooled by the constant low inventory media narrative. The new home sales report, along with the serial decline in the housing starts data, also disproves the low inventory narrative. Affordability, rising rates, and a shrinking pool of potential home buyers who can qualify for a conforming mortgage has torpedoed demand, and consumer sentiment toward buying a home is now at its lowest reading since 2008. And more inconvenient facts keep piling up. According to the California Association of Realtors, existing home sales plunged 7.3% from June of 2017, and inventory is now up 8.1%. Housing starts for June came in at 1.17 million, whereas the market was looking for 1.32 million. This represents a 12.3% drop from May, a data point that is not statistically insignificant. The May report was revised lower. Starts for both single-family and multifamily homes were down sharply across the entire country. If inventory was low, as the narrative constantly implies, wouldn't housing starts actually be soaring instead of falling? Just asking. The article concludes, and I agree, that the manic phase of the housing bubble is over. Momentum has been shifting in the opposite direction since late 2017. If you follow certain markets on Zillow, for example, like I do, you've seen the exact same thing. Some home flippers are now getting desperate to sell. Some are renting their properties out, but rents in some places are now moving below the cost of carry. The change in housing represents some of the most important financial data you can monitor. The impact of this market permeates into all aspects of the economy. If the inconvenient housing facts from the first half of 2018 are cause for concern, the second half of 2018 and all of 2019 could signal the beginning of another wild economic ride none of us wants to be on. Buckle up. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.